If these objects that have been stolen come back to Africa, we need also to work from the continent in Africa to welcome them, not only in places such as whatever, museums, schools. We need to invent new languages to reactivate them. For many reasons, some of them have lost their language.
Says Kader Atia, who has just opened his exhibition Kader Atia, J'accuse at Berlinische Galerie. We are actually sitting in the gallery right now. Maybe you hear the sounds of the installation in the background. The artist grew up in France and Algeria. He lived in South America and in Congo, and he curated the Berlin Biennial in 2022. I want to find out what and whom he accuses. So welcome to the podcast Was macht die Kunst by Weltkunst Magazine. What is your art up to in your current exhibition, dear Kader Atia?
I accuse injustice. I accuse the instrumentalization of power to produce injustice. Remember that J'accuse was first created by Émile Zola in his article in the L'Aurore, where he actually defended, because he was convinced of the innocence of the Captain Dreyfus, who was not only fired from the army, but also deported and in jail for being a spy, was a lie. And because of his brother, was the first to believe in his innocence. A whole movement of, again, Dreyfus from this ignominious anti-Semitic affair of the end of the 19th century in France. I would say this is very important because this is a moment where the French society has revealed that almost half of the French society was anti-Semite at that time. So it's a significant moment, which we could compare, and then I will go to J'accuse, but it has to do with the same period of time of the film, of this face-to-face between Léon Blum and the Maréchal Pétain after World War II. So let's go back after, just before that. Abel Gance, who was a pacifist activist, also a director, after World War I, was, like many, many citizens, many European citizens, German, French, Belgian, American, many were against the war. They understood, after the hell of 4 years of incredible battles and a number of dead people, that the world should never know this again. Abel Gance wanted to do a film that he named J'accuse, accusing this abuse of power. Accusing nationalism, I would say, because like Jean Jaurès used to say, nationalism is war. Le nationalisme, c'est la guerre. He visited quite more than 200 faces, wounded faces, soldiers from First World War, to ask them to feature in the film. Because for him, it was very important to show the horror, the violence of the war. They all declined the invitation. So he anyway shot his film with actors who were like with makeup, looking like ghosts. 16 years after, with the rise of tensions again in Europe.
This is now in the 30s?
In the 30s. So the rise of fascism in Germany, in Spain, in Italy, everywhere in Europe. There was a feeling that something was going very wrong again. And this convinced Abel Gance that he really had to show to the public, to the world, the horror of the war, the injuries of the war. He went back, he asked like 16 years before, some of them have died, but many of the others were still alive. He asked them again to feature in the film, telling them how much it was important. We speak about, if I'm not wrong, 1938, something like this. So Hitler was already in power, etc. They all agreed to participate. And for me, this means a lot. It means that there is a moment where we have to open our eyes and we have to walk against this disaster, this catastrophe that is the war, particularly a world war, which involves so many countries. So they accepted, and you have in the film this part that I'm showing, which is the end, where a kind of prophetic character is trying to sort of, I mean, calm down the anger of the crowd, telling them that you are crazy, you should not do the war again, that's the worst thing we have to do. And they don't listen to him, they even mock him, they almost end by lynching him, attaching him on a sort of a stage. And then in this prophetic sort of expressionist monologue, he's calling the dead to show to the living the horror of the war. And then you have this movement, beautiful, very much of this period of, you know, cinema, mixing like effect and the return of all these millions of soldiers who died from all countries. And at this moment, you see those real soldiers appearing in the film. For me, it's very important to try to create an artistic experience using representation, such as the one that I've made history, like the film of Gantz, and the very strong message that sounds so much, that echoes so much the world we are living in today. And also as an artist, I'm trying to make this experience tangible with sculptures that have been inspired by injured soldiers from the war, all from facial injuries, who have been called in France les gueules cassées, broken faces. And they have incarnated sort of the modern violence of the war. We have to remember that World War I was almost a 19th century war, but with weapons of the 20th century, very modern for that time. And that's why you have all these incredible injuries. It was a butchery, actually. For me, to end with this question of artistic experience as a physical and much needed one, it was the idea of displaying this installation of wood sculptures looking at the film and creating a sort of space for the viewers to circulate in between the film and the sculptures and to meditate about the message that this dialogue creates.
It's a very, very powerful experience and very gripping, of course, to see these strong faces that are so almost abstract. You have a face with features. Everyone recognizes eyes, nose, mouth. But then when war happens like that and totally disfigures a human being, it's almost as if this is a material for an artist to create something new, to make shapes that don't look like a face anymore. So I find it very gripping, but I also think it inspires a lot of thoughts about what art is and what nature is and how human nature interferes and kind of creates something that's really terrifying. You put a lot of faces and some also some limbs, some prosthesis looking like half a leg or something, and you made them out of very rough wood. How did you go about making them, and also where did you find the images? Because it does look like it comes from somewhere. It's not all invented by you.
No.
You saw the photographs of these soldiers. And we have to say, I never knew this, I only learned this in your exhibition, that hundreds of thousands of Africans fought in World War I for France. And so these are African faces that you're showing mostly.
Some of them.
Okay.
Not all of them.
Okay.
But I did researches in Germany and France. And in Paris, I found at the Hôpital du Val de Grâce in Paris, which was the military hospital of Paris, well, a significant amount of portraits of injured faces soldiers. When you sculpt faces, it's always better to have the face and the profile. I was very lucky because I found these images in, it's an incredible story, by the way. They were hiding behind a wall. The guy who told, I mean, the captain, he was a captain because it's a military hospital, Captain Tabag, told me that this was found by them, I think in the 80s or 90s.
So a whole lot of photographs.
When they destroy to renovate a room behind the wall, there was this box with other things, and there were these photographs. It's very interesting how much there is a kind of metaphysical force that sometimes, like a message in a bottle, when I found these images. For me, it was echoing so much the question of repair in a very complex way. I've been working for many years. Maybe you saw the project I showed in 2012 at Documenta called The Repair from Extra-Occidental Culture. And I've always been fascinated by the way almost proto-societies, you know, not really like developed societies, were actually considering the fixing things, repairing things, fixing jars, fixing objects. For me, the question of repair is very interesting. We can speak about this later. But when I look at this portrait, I found that it's very interesting because some of the repair of these faces were almost like calabashes repaired in Africa or kintsugi object in Japan or wooden object in the West, but in pre-modern time. Like some faces had staples very roughly. Some of them were stitched like a calabash. So I was fascinated by the emergency of the fixing that World War I created. Needless to say that, you know, it's even more impressive. Most of these repairs were made by women. Because in the battlefield, after the bombing, you had these guys who were carrying the injured people who were still alive, like, you know. But those who needed repair immediately were repaired by young nurses. Girls who were like 16 years old. And then, because I live in Germany, I was also very interested by the opposite side, you know, because in Germany, there were obviously also a lot of injured faces, but it was much more difficult to find archives. And then I found a fantastic book of a doctor whose name was Dr. Joseph here in Berlin. He was a specialist of the Nasen. He was also repairing this facial reconstruction. Slowly, I started to find out that in these images, there were, most of them were white, but there were sometimes Arabs and black subjects. Then I discovered that these non-Western subjects, what we call in France, tirailleurs Algérien and tirailleurs Senegalais, which were Arab Berber units, were all the North African soldiers. Senegalese units, tirailleurs Senegalais, were all sub-Saharan subjects. It does not mean that because of Senegalese, they were from Senegal. You could have from Congo, from Ivory Coast. As an artist, you can be very sensitive to the plasticity of these faces because it raises a question. This question that a friend artist, very old, told me some years ago, saying that I would not be surprised that after the World War I, particularly right after in 1918, Paris was also flooded with these soldiers coming from the front. And those artists of the Montparnasse, who were not, because they were foreigners, involved in the war, like Picasso, for instance, I would not be surprised to imagine that Picasso saw them. Mm-hmm. What is clear is that the aesthetic of these faces, for me, raises the question of beauty. What does it mean, beauty? Jacques Derrida used to say that the beauty is maybe the rarity for the most rare face, you know, in the sense that the perfect symmetrical face would be the beauty because it's extremely rare. But then also a totally asymmetrical face might be the beauty. Might be beautiful. I've been working so much on this with my hacks on the wood that I discovered that there's something close to this question of beauty that comes through the unexpected. And then when you work with these hacks on the wood, it's so uncontrollable, this tool. If you work with the axe, the result is much more random, actually. If you get like obsessed by having a detail, you will never get it. And I like this kind of resistance of the material, of the medium. It's even more than the medium resisting to you. I think it's the artwork. I think each sculpture that you will see on the other side, particularly the faces, are both conversation but argument between the work and myself, which ended without handing by a conclusion which is, okay, I have to accept that if this is a mistake, maybe it's beautiful. And that's why I really advocate the importance of mistake in art, because it's a way to leave space to this force I was telling you before. You don't know why these photographs come to you. The same you have to, particularly with sculpture, but it could be with painting and drawing. I think the notion of what we call mistake, we shouldn't interpret it differently than something negative. And that's why the creation of these works is not random. You follow, of course, the photograph, you know. Mm-hmm. But you cannot have, if the moment you stay focused and obsessed by a detail, you completely destroy the sculpture. If just the eye is not good, I have thrown away many.
No.
Yeah, you know, when the eye is not good, you look at them. And then people around me, like my assistant, they don't understand because the face is already completely destroyed. But I know by feeling when, even if the whole face is destroyed, you can feel that the guy here is alive. Because in the picture, you see it alive. The only thing I try to reproduce in this work is actually probably the beauty of life in its complexity.
What's also fitting is the material. You take wood, and maybe you can also say a little bit what kind of wood you choose for this project. But when you hack your axe into the wood, whatever you chop off is gone. So it's really a sculpture in the best sense that you take something away to create the shape, but it also is a little bit like, let's say, it's almost like an aggressive act to chop something out of a block of wood. It has this correlation, I think, to the topic that you are treating with it.
Very important what you said, particularly as a sculptor, because people have no idea that sculpting is exactly as you define it. You remove, particularly with wood, if you remove piece of wood, it means that you cannot go back. And I never use, for this work, wooden glue. Never. It's not smart. It will fall one day. But if you keep the monolithic block with all these details you have carved or etched, then this will stay forever. Wood is alive. Even when it's dead, the wood is alive. There are also sometimes dead wood I work with, because I like the fact that the injury of the wood is also merging with the injury represented of the soldier. This question of removing is also a conversation with the matter. Particularly when you work on this kind of object, I use gimbo wood that comes from Senegal. It's a wood we can export. It was very important for me that I can ship it. I work with an assistant who make the bowl first and then the piece of the body. And then the whole detail, I do them myself. If you look at the trace of the blade, you can feel that the wood has been like heated in a very energetic way. And for me, it's a kind of echo of what I'm representing, the violence of the war, the violence of the injury. I think one of the most difficult things is that you cannot go back. You have this very dangerous tool, but there is a kind of trance that comes after hours of walking. When you walk hours outside with the outside light, the light change. At the end of the afternoon, the light reveal all these angle of the, created by the blade. And it can really change the work that you did, actually. So you have to also stay focused, looking for this moment where you're going to say, okay, I think it's finished. Or maybe it will be unfinished, but now I have to stop. When we sculpt, you produce actually traces. The traces are not your traces. The traces that you do produce have come a long journey to arrive at this moment. All your ancestors, not only your family, these traces that we produce constantly since we left the caves, how it defined human epistemology, and also going back to what is beauty, what is texture, what is violence, what is an injury. So that's why you need this kind of trance, but also you need awareness of all these factors in this decision of, okay, now I have to stop, and then I'll come back tomorrow. And then when you come back with a fresh eye also, sometimes it's clear crystal. Okay, it's great. Oh, no. Oh, my God.
We are now sitting in an installation here that has a lot to do with provenance. But even the other room with Jacques, that's also some kind of provenance. You take a work, Jacques by Zola. Then it is also a film, Jacques, in the 30s. And now it became an installation with sculpture and film together. So I think even in your own work, you have some ancestors that you...
I
honor
absolutely
with the title even. So this installation we're sitting in right now is in a way totally different, but in some ways also similar, because you also have sculptures looking at a film projection. And the film projection here is now a totally different kind of way of working. You interviewed various people that are in the field of restitution. You spoke with philosophers, with economists, with art historians, psychologists, and heirs of the kings of Dahomey about restitution. Sculptures that were once looted from Africa and I guess also the South Seas. But they are copies, either 3D printed copies, or they are what you call airport art, some sculptures that were made for tourists. And it's very interesting to see these works. What does it mean that these sculptures are now looking at a film of the experts talking about restitution? What does this mean to you?
Talking about the question of restitution, for me, it was very important to try to see this debate from the affect. Before, I was telling you that I'm interested by the question of authenticity because it's never spoken. Maybe I will do something one day, but there are also other aspects of the object that I think have never been really researched, you know. And 4 years ago, I was very interested by the fact that there is an affect dimension in this debate between both sides that is crucial, and we need to understand this. And that's why in my film, you have the two sides represented, those who are against restitution, like the lawyer who is skeptical and is using a whole apparatus of laws, etc. The reason I wanted to then insist on this aspect of the object was not to include them only in the film, but I wanted to make their presence shared with the audience on the film. So they are looking at the film, but also the shadow of their presence, of the object, is actually projected on the screen. So they are not only watching the film, they are in the film. The presence of the shadow of the film, the fact that the object are more in the room than in the film, makes that this is an installation. I think art should be, particularly in exhibition space, only an artistic experience, or let's say first an artistic physical experience, and then it can be an artistic intellectual experience. And that's why for me, the idea, like in J'accuse, that viewers can both watch the film, watch the sculpture, circulate within the plinth of the sculpture, basically within the sculptures, sit, the way the chairs are installed is parallel to the wall, so that you can both watch the film and look at the sculpture. So you're part of the installation, but you also still into a relation with the projection because you are not facing the screen. I think the reason I'm using only copies is also, as far as I'm concerned, very important. I've been working on this topic for almost 20 years now. The first project I did was sort of critique of the collection of ethnography at the Vatican. It's a slideshow. In 2007, I started to work on this. We still need to understand in this debate on restitution that there are copies, even copies that have 30 years, you know, made in the 90s, which are copies. They have never been used. And when you know the original that are in museum, you put them side by side. It's like, a very good wine and a bottle of
vinegar.
Thank you. So I think, and at least with vinegar, you can do salad. The difference of the copy, when you are very close to this field, which I'm not, I don't have the skills of tribal art galleries or collectors or anthropologists, is significant. The reason I wanted to mix here copies of wood and kind of old copies from the 90s, from maybe 10 years, some of them have like 2 or 3 years, even if they look old, and some other are in nylon, acrylic, epoxy, so they are like brand new, made with a 3D printer, is that I really wanted to incarnate this confusion, that is the debate, in terms also of authenticity, and also of not absurdity, but confusion, which is very much at the image of the society we live today. We live in a society where confusion is actually ruling the world and our perception of the world. We get lost in context of, for instance, demonstration today. So that's why I wanted to create this installation in order to also turn on the question of being aware that what you see is not what you get. In terms of the debate on restitution, you really need to sit to listen to these people who have the skills, the skill of their fields of researchers, and just to listen to them and in their personal opinion, let's say arguing each other, and then you leave the place with something that is less than, you know, a kind of very minimal Facebook post or social media argument.
In your opinion, how does the repatriation of these objects influence the relationships between former colonial powers and their former colonies? The Republic of Benin, for example?
It's the whole question that is evoked, for instance, by her, Christine Theodore. This is what she says when she said that we cannot claim that there is restitution about something we have stolen. It's something that has been stolen, and when you give it back, there's no nobility in this, you know. The problem of this act of restitution until today, I think, is that it seems that the initial intention was not ethic and absolutely not political, but more economical. How to rebuild strong relation between France and its former colonies in a context where China and Russia, particularly China, was taking over in Africa. Most of the people, when you go to symposium about restitution in Dakar, for instance, most of the students, they don't want to hear about the object, the mask, etc. When they talk about restitution, they do expect to talk about raw materials, cocoa, iron, the whole amount, huge amount of money that was taken from Africa by the West. This is what they want to get back. For me, of course, as an artist, I care more about cultural heritage, but I was listening this carefully as something that was significant and not part of the debate on restitution. So unfortunately, I think that It's not because the West bringing back object to Africa that the colonial relation that has lasted since then, called coloniality, is fixed, and we can start now equal and okay, we have given back your object, and now we can look at each other in a very transparent way, etc. I don't think it is working, to be honest. If these objects that have been stolen come back to Africa, we need also to work from the continent in Africa to welcome them, not only in places such as whatever, museums, schools. We need to invent new languages to reactivate them. For many reasons, some of them have lost their language. Yeah, some community have lost the language to activate them. Cannot end up in another white cube with conditioner hair. The world has changed. The incarnation of this object was complex. It has to become again complex. So let's say it has to sort of cement the society that has become orphan of this legacy. But what is important is how we can create the place for the return of this object. And I think that when this place will be done, the relation between the West and non-Western, or let's say the former colonizers, then will be cemented again, will work again. And I don't think the work is only a job that the West has to do. And it's not me, I'm quoting Felwin here, who very nicely and smartly as he is, set up the sort of, the ground of what should receive the return of this object, which is not existing right now.
Also, it's maybe a little bit like chopping a block of wood. You can't just glue it back on. You have to be somehow inventive.
Exactly. You have to accept it.
You also picked for the exhibition here at Berlinische Galerie a set of Hannah Höch collages. What do they mean to you?
I mean, I really love the work of Hannah Höch. Didn't start with this exhibition. Start almost 20 years ago. I was always fascinated by the collage and the photomontage and basically two, let's say, German artists were major for me in the collage is Kurt Schwitters and Hannah Höch. But Hannah Höch, I would say, has this particular interesting relation with non-Western cultures using African mask mixed with photographs of environment, Germany, Berlin in the 30s, or 20s. I think she raises one of the significant political questions we talk about today regarding restitution. What does it mean to represent cultures when you are a subject living in another culture, which basically benefits from the colonization of these cultures? How to be Kirchner, to be Karl Schmidt Rottluff, to be, Nolde, painting masks from Ostsee or from the Dogon, from representing them. I'm just questioning what does it mean, because some of them were, we could discover later in their notes, in their diary, they were like very skeptical against colonialism, some of them, they wrote about that. So when I had the opportunity to exhibit here at the Berlinische Galerie, during the Biennale time, I was doing researches on artists who have been working on that issue, indirectly or directly. And I discovered that there was in the collection of the Berlinische Galerie a significant number of beautiful collages. It was really the best moment to create conversation with this artist that I will never stop to love, because for me, she has not only an incredible endless creativity with her medium, but also the fact that these, I would say, composition that she created, for me, also working on with collage technique for, let's say, 15 years, not with this topic, but more with injured faces and architecture. I know that when you work with collage, you always like leave your desk or table full of pieces of paper overlapping each other. And sometimes when you leave the place for 2 days because you'll be tired of the studio and you come back by night, you discover juxtaposition of two elements that have nothing to do together, incredibly strong and harmonic. And then you either take a picture or you take the two elements, you put them on the side, you let them live for months. And if every time you come back to them, to these two elements, you see this strong energy of meanings that is happening between them, you decide to glue them. I was always fantasizing this moment that other artists collage, particularly Anna Oesch. Kurt Schwitter is different because he's doing also small collage. But with Anna Oesch, I was wondering if sometimes she ended up by some juxtaposition that were like by chance produced because of, you know, the disorder you leave on your table. I don't think they are disorder or chaos. I think everything comes from an energy that we could call art, we could call something, I don't know. But something like what I was telling you before about these traces that are before us and actually project themselves into the now, into the very now, the moment, into an artwork, into an artistic experience. Yeah, it's my way of course, interpreting Anna Oesch. Actually, the artwork is also telling you something, you know? It's also resisting you. You have to listen to this resistance and therefore to accept it sometimes, not always.
If time travel was real, what place and period would you visit?
Rome.
Ancient Rome?
Yeah, definitely. Rome, antique Rome, yeah.
What is your most important tool?
I would say the axe.
If you were an animal, what would it be?
I think a dog or a cat. I know they are very different, but I like them very much.
Which game do you like to play?
Chess.
What is your favorite color?
It changes. I think red.
Do you have a recurring dream?
I have many, sometimes vertigo, like I'm floating in the sky.
Do you listen to music while you work?
I prefer to really lie and listen music, to stay completely into the music.
Which topic would you like to see in an entire issue of Weltkunst?
I would say the repair.
Can you share a wisdom?
I have a couple, but frankly, the one that would make sense with what we spoke today is that we never really die. I think we continue to live through the traces that we leave, not only your artwork, but all this conversation, these what we do produce are traces, mnemonic traces, which is memories. And therefore, I think we never really die.
That is a beautiful last word. Thank you very, very much. Was macht die Kunst is produced in partnership with Volkswagen Group Culture. Volkswagen is also partner of National Gallery Berlin and offers free entry to Neue Nationalgalerie on Thursdays between 4 and 8 p.m. On Sundays from noon to 5 p.m., we recommend Volkswagen Group Art for All Family Sunday at Hamburger Bahnhof with lots to discover for families.